Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight I have Mason Stokes, author of Saving Julian, a new novel. It's his first novel. It's an exciting book that is a dark comic. I love this. Dark comic journeys on the blur, but really it's a fun book. It's literally ripped right from the headlines. I got it on the day that President Obama said that he was going to end ex-gay therapy, and of course that's what the novel is about. Mason, good evening.
Nate, thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
You're welcome. Were you just totally shocked on April 9th when the White House made that announcement?
I was. You know, I had begun to feel the trend moving in that direction. I think about 18 or 19 state legislatures currently have bills
right.
pending that would ban reparative therapy. But I didn't actually expect to hear it from the president. And
right.
it felt like a real sort of moment for me. It felt like a paradigm shift of some sorts.
Right. And it's funny because it was the day I started reading your book, which was about 3 weeks ago. You know, I don't like to do it too early because then I forget. I'm old.
Sure.
But it was amazing, and I don't know if our listeners were following it as closely as I'm a geek because I follow LGBT history and as a geek, but that proclamation came from 120,000 online signature on WhiteHouse.gov. President Obama started a program where if 100,000 people ask for something, he will respond, and 120,000 people asked for this. And the response was yes. He's going to.
And that came in the wake, if I'm right, and I don't have the name, but there was a young trans teen who actually committed suicide, and
correct.
not entirely the same thing as ex-gay conversion, but certainly someone coming out of a family whose parents
right.
Insisted on change. Right.
Right. I believe it was bullying. I'm not 100% sure, but I think you're right. I think it wasn't exactly an ex-gay thing. Maybe it was. I don't think we know because I think it was one of those things where the parents said he was with Christ and God, and it was you could tell there was a religious issue, and that made it they buried the whole thing. He was buried as buried in his not his chosen gender. He was buried
right.
as a man. Yeah, he was buried. That's correct. I remember that now. Well, anyway, let's get back to the book. The book was hilarious. First of all, Saving Julian, Mason Stokes. You can get it on Kindle. Is it on Kindle yet?
It's available on Kindle. It's also available through paperback from Amazon and other online outlets.
Okay, masonstokes.com, masonstokes.com, Saving Julian, Amazon.com, and Kindle. I like to push Kindle because it doesn't use any gasoline. Anyway, okay. I love the book. I had a great time. Your prose is beautiful. Tell us a little bit how you became such an excellent writer.
Well, I appreciate that, Nate. That's wonderful to hear. And, you know, my journey to being a novelist was a weird and somewhat unpredictable one. I wasn't trained as a novelist. I actually was trained as a scholar, a literary critic. I'm an English professor. And when people used to ask me, when they would hear that I was an English professor, they would say, oh, you must write novels. And I said, no, I've never written a novel. I never will. That's not the kind of writing I do.
Uh-huh.
And at some point in the middle of my last academic project, I got really tired of the project. I got tired of the questions that I was asking. And I just started writing something that felt like the thing I wanted to write. And I wasn't sure what it was. But it turned into a first novel, not Saving Julian, but a novel I wrote before this that my agent wasn't quite able to sell. In this marketplace, it's tough. But
yeah.
It was a long journey to being a fiction writer, but I think your question is about writing in general. And I've just been a reader for as long as I can remember. And
yeah.
I really think that's what makes you a writer. I think that's what gives you a sense of prose, of rhythm, of tone, effect. I really think it's about reading everything you can find, all different sorts of stuff, and making that a lifetime's pursuit. So, you know, I also teach writing. I teach my students to be better writers, and there's something about teaching writing that makes you a better writer yourself. But
right.
I've got to say, I think it's first and foremost, it's about being a reader.
Being a reader, great, great. All right, well, let's get back to the novel. As I mentioned earlier about ex-gay therapy, it revolves around a really a threesome, not a threesome that gets together, excuse me, but three men mostly. There's other people come in, of course, but who there's a protagonist. There's our sad Dr. Paul Drucker, the professor and minister, who is doing work on ex-gay therapy, lecturing. He's kind of the voice, national voice of kind of the Tony Perkins and Molly Gallagher. Did I say that name right from NAMM? Yeah.
Absolutely right. Yeah, that's right.
And he's just, you know, just a pill. And, of course, he's caught with a 21-year-old escort who then he says was on this trip with him to lift his luggage. And the picture of him, of course, is lifting his luggage. And, you of course, as some of readers know, this is based on a 2010 incident by George Allen Rikers, Dr. George Allen Rikers, a real person, who is now at the University of Florida, and a young gentleman called Johnny Roman, his escort, who he hired. And George Allen Rikers testified in the Proposition 8 case out in California. He was a major witness out there. He also was a major witness here trying to squash a bill of a federal case that had an adoption issue, and that's when I actually met George Allen Rikers, because
I've never met anyone who's met him, so this is a thrill for me in a weird, perverse kind of sense.
It is a weird, perverse kind of thing. I know, and I as I said to Mason earlier, I have been trying to get a hold of, through my network of 6 degrees of separation, I was trying to get a hold of the young man who was the escort in this case, but he has vanished off the face of the earth. He does live in Florida, but I couldn't find him. I mean, I couldn't get a hold of him.
Mm.
Okay, so you've set this up, and there's this gentleman named Aaron in the book who I figured was you.
Yeah, that's a fair enough assumption, right? Aaron is one of the novel's narrators. It's a novel that's told in multiple voices, so the narration switches. But Aaron is, I would say, a younger version of myself with some differences thrown in. So he's a 28-year-old grad student who falls into the orbit of both Paul Drucker and the escort, Julian. And it really turns his life upside down. And I thought Aaron was going to be the character that I was most interested in, because I sort of began there in some sense. It was a projection of me. But what ended up happening, and I was a little surprised by this, is that the character of Drucker, and again, you got it right. Drucker is based in part on George Rikers, but also on any number of the other closeted sort of evildoers that we could pick from the headlines. So I got really fascinated with that character, and I wanted to try to figure out from the inside what that man felt like. And that's why it became a real pleasure to write that character in the first person, to try to not immediately condemn, but try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
The scary thing that began to happen was some degree of identification or even sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
Because I began to realize, and I sort of put this awareness into my character Aaron, that I'm quick to condemn. I think that kind of figure, the ex-gay conversion sort of prophet, is doing real significant harm to people every day. I think there's a certain kind of murderousness that happens there. And yet I found myself, in trying to write that character from the inside, realizing that, you know, it's not like I popped out of the womb fully formed as an out and proud gay man, right? That was a journey for me. That took me a while, and I recognize in a figure like Drucker some of my own fear and shame and denial that I lived through as a younger man. And now, of course, I never I took that shame and denial out really only on myself. I never turned it against other people, as these figures do. But there's an unsettling commonality there that has to do with a certain kind of internalized homophobia, and fear of the body, a certain kind of shame.
Correct.
You don't simply purge those things easily. And so I really enjoyed trying to figure this guy out, to write him from the inside.
And I take notes as I read books when I do a show like this. It's almost like I'm doing a live review when I speak to the author. And I have a note stuck to my computer that said, "Paul sounds normal and balanced at first." And he does. I mean, as I said, at first. I mean, because when you first meet him, he is truly believing what he says. You know, there is a sense of, you know, a lot of these people. I mean, I'm 64, so my coming out was before the American Psychiatric Association said this wasn't a disease. So it was a little more difficult. So I could see myself saying I've said these things to myself. You know, if there was only a way to change, you know, I'm not working hard enough at it. I'm not praying hard enough. It's my fault. And so that's a normal reaction. And that was a normal reaction for someone who didn't know the facts and, you know, and or believe the facts. And so I do believe that, you know, and the quote I have that I want to share with everybody that Paul says is that the homosexuals that he meets, he doesn't call them gay. I don't think he calls them gay. They were pure because they hated themselves and wanted to change. That he found a purity in that desire to change. And I went, that's all of us at some point. So really there was a, I was going to ready to hate him because I hate all these people. And, you know, I know they're dinosaurs and I know we're not going to hear from them in, you know, a few months, a few years. This will all be we'll all laugh about this, like Orville Fabus and the Little Rock Nine, but people are going to start Googling Orville Fabus right now.
I hope so. That's great.
I hope so too. I mean, let's do a history lesson tonight, which is, it's the same lesson. But you know, you're really right. It is not as, what I found about Saving Julian, I think the tagline that I got was, "Nothing's black and white." You know.
Well, I'm that's really gratifying to hear. I mean, that's certainly what I was shooting for, because it would be so easy to write this character as a simple monster, as one dimensional, and he may have begun that way in my mind because that's the way I felt about these real life versions. But that did shift for me. And you know, the other thing I want to point out, and you've mentioned this too, and I appreciate it, that I did want to write a novel that felt to me ultimately funny. That it's a comic novel, and it's a comic novel about a really unfunny subject matter. And that was the thing I wanted to try. It was important to me to try to get that right. One of my favorite novelists is a guy named Alan Gerganis, who has written a novel called Plays Well with Others, which is really about the early days of the AIDS crisis in the arts community in New York. And Alan had read lots of AIDS memoirs and AIDS novels, and he wanted to try to write a comedy about that moment. And that sounds like an impossible thing to pull off, and he was able to do it. I don't want to put myself in that category. I'm nowhere near it, but I was trying to find the humor in this topic, which quite frankly enrages me, right? So how do you – I mean, when you think about these guys, and I get so angry about the kind of things that they're doing, particularly for our most vulnerable people, our queer sons and daughters. So there's a lot of anger when I think about this, but I wanted to sort of step around that and actually try to find the humor, because it's also deeply funny. I mean, you know, another thing that Drucker says to people is – he says, "There's no such thing as a gay man. There are only men with unmet homo-emotional love needs."
Yeah.
That phrase, "unmet homo-emotional love needs," struck me as funny the first time I saw it in one of these self-help books. And there is something perversely comic about...
You didn't make that up?
I'll confess that I actually stole that from one of the many Pray Away the Gay books that I read while researching this novel.
I thought you made that up.
No, well, see, it's It's true, stranger than fiction, right? You would have to make that up. But
yeah.
No, I didn't. I lifted it from the
God.
Pages of one of these Pray Away the Gay books. And you might also remember the novel deals with this sort of something called a holding therapy, which involves men with same-sex desire holding one another to sort of to get away from the sexual desire. And I didn't make that up either. That's actually from one of the books I was working from as a source.
Yes, yes. I've heard of that through I grew up in the Orthodox Jewish community, actually. My family is Hasidic. I have 169 first cousins, nieces, and nephews. And, you're from New York. You know what I'm talking about. Anyway, right. And the holding therapy was part of Jonah, which is also a discredited anti-ex-gay movement. I keep saying anti, but Jonah was in terrible had some awful experiences. They did some a lot of nudity and showering together. The showering together is right out of a Jonah thing, where you're supposed to shower together as buddies.
Right.
You know, put a bunch of
gay
men.
And I do have that scene in the novel. There's always got to be the group shower scene, and there it is.
Yeah, and I just can't imagine that as therapy. I mean, and of course the other thing is, as we've discovered, is that religious organizations have an exemption from having professionals do counseling. That people that are just go through theology can be mental health counselors and collect Blue Cross and Medicare and Medicaid money and not be clinical licensed psychologists or therapists, because we have these religious the religious part in is and of course it runs pretty deep in your book. It's on every other page is the word Jesus or God or Christ or pray. I mean it's a very not always in a reverent way. Mostly it's irreverent, especially when you have a 21-year-old escort and a graduate student writing about. And I said one of the things that makes this so funny is, I'm going to share a little more of the book, is that the graduate student begins and he's writing a thesis that involves Judd Apatow and homoerotic penis images. Did I get that right?
I think you did. That sounds right to me. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you wrote it. I read it weeks ago. I just remembered you said it was a comedy. And I mean, whenever you mention Judd Apatow to anybody, you always get a smile because you think of Bridesmaids. You think of Knocked Up. I can't remember the other one.
Right.
They're all.
But Apatow is also it's an interesting reference because he is the great architect of the sort of male romance movie.
Yes.
But it's not about homosexuality, right? But
no,
all of these guys are in love with each other more than they are with any women they'll ever meet.
Right, right. The guys are all cool. The women are all shrills in all of his movies.
Right.
You know, they're all shrills. They're all idiots. They never understand. The guys just have to look at each other, and they get this instant connection. That's a Judd Apatow movie, whether he writes it or he's in it, or you know. And you're exactly right. So that was a funny thing. And the other thing is, I think he's the one who has an open penis in every movie. Doesn't he have frontal?
I think that's right. There's a Jason Segel full frontal and. That movie in which he's breaking up with this Hollywood actress. I can't remember the name.
Right. Right. Then I think every movie.
Yeah. It's a thing he does. It's a little trope.
Either he directs or I think so. That in itself is a whole other. I mean, I don't want to get away from Saving Julian, but the whole other thing of making a man comfortable, because you know chick flicks. They're all chick flicks. There's got to be a guy in the thing has got to look at another guy's junk. You know.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's always the great unasked question, and it's the source of every sort of nervous energy in the room.
Exactly.
And the line between that and wanting to do something with that junk is so fraught that people freak out about it.
Exactly. You mean the only one that I had heard of he does talk about SAD, SSAD, same sex attachment disorder, which of course is the holding. The thing where you didn't get along with whatever spouse. In other words, if you're a man, you didn't get along with your father. If you're a woman, you didn't get attached to your mother correctly or whatever. And if that were the case, there would be like 80% of the population would be gay, and we wouldn't have all these problems.
I've got to tell you this story. I was teaching I teach a course in queer fiction, and I was teaching James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room.
Okay.
And that's a novel that's really invested in that kind of Freudian model that you're talking about not getting the love from your father, getting too much from your mother. And I was explaining this to my class and telling them, and it's a discredited Freudian theory. But I had an older gay man in the class auditing the class, and he put his hand up and he said, "I got to tell you, I know you're saying it's discredited, but every gay man I've ever met had an absent father and overbearing mother." And I simply said, "Well, if every man who ever had an absent or distant father turned out to be gay, this would be a very different world for us."
Yeah.
And a lot more fun.
And a lot more fun. Yeah, I think when you're gay, and there's also the goggles on reverse, when you're gay and afraid to share with your father, you feel like your father is absent. You know, your view of the world isn't necessarily the correct one when you're 6, 8, 9 years old. You may think your father is absent, and he really isn't. But you're absent.
Right.
You're the one who's pulling back. And your mother may not be overbearing, but you are doting on every word trying to keep her happy. And so, it's a two-way street. I am married to Dr. Raphael Klarfeld, who is a Freudian psychoanalyst who worked for 25 years in the gay community in Dallas as the only male openly gay psychiatrist. So I hear this stuff all day long, and I just kind of go,
And you know, it's still whatever we now know about the ways in which Freud got some stuff wrong, the stories he told are still so resonant with us. They still feel sometimes true. And that, I think that's a part of, again, the sort of insidiousness of what these ex-gay sort of prophets are up to, which is they've found a rhetoric and a language that really does tap into every insecurity and vulnerability we have.
Exactly. Right.
And we're afraid to talk about those things because those things it would sort of align us with those people who hate us, those people who are trying to change us. And so it's a thing we're uncomfortable talking about, but there is this sort of scary resonance, even as we know it's evil in some way. And targeting our very sort of lives, it's still a thing that it rings true on occasion in ways that we're really quite uncomfortable with, I think.
No, you're right. And as we talked about earlier, it's a lot their language. I don't think they realize the damage that they're doing to young people, and they're listening. Young people are listening. I talked to you a little bit before the show started. This show has a large youth 18 to 24 year old demographic in rural areas. We know this from our when you listen to something or download something online, there's an algorithm. So we know all these. I don't know, but I get all this information. And they are listening. They're online. They're on tap. I mean, they're listening to you. You think, oh no, they're not listening to the news. They're getting their news from amazing sources. And it's not always good. It's not always reliable. But when these people say these things, and you're some poor kid with no social support system, nobody to talk to out in a rural area. And remember, a lot of people live in small towns or in religious communities like, you know, Orthodox Jewish communities, Mennonite communities, small evangelical communities, you know, the Duggar crazy family, the Quiverful people. Mm. I mean, those people don't see other people. But the internet and their smartphones are how these kids break out, and they do hear everything. And I think that's where we really need to tell these people that what they say when they just say these things about, gays can't adopt children because they're not good parents. What they're saying to a 10 or 12 year old who has parents is that I'm not good enough. You know, I'm sick. There's something wrong with me. I can't, you know, I'm not a whole person. And that's where I want to step in with a voice and say, look, this next generation needs nurturing, not hate. And you're fucking it up. You're screwing it up.
It's absolutely right. It's enraging. Yeah.
Yeah. Back to that. Okay. So I'm going to start talking. We have some questions on How did you get published? Somebody asked for the chat room. We have a chat room. How did you get published?
That's a really good question, and it's as you know, it's really hard these days, not simply to get published, but to get published in what's read as gay fiction, because independent gay publishers are having as hard a time as major trade presses. And so, you know, Allison was for a long time the big gay and lesbian press. They went under. And so, you know, with that first novel I wrote, I got an agent and we made the rounds of the major publishers and I got some good feedback, but no one knew how to sell it or to market it, I think, because of its gay content. So with the second book, I actually just took a different route and started targeting small independent presses because I had gotten tired of hearing all of the marketing logics from the major trade presses.
Sure.
It's really about how big is your platform, how many people do you already have, are you Oprah? And I'm not Oprah, not even on
or
a good day. And
or
so,
Dr. Phil. Or Dr. Phil.
Or Dr. Phil, right? So I actually, through submitting to sort of small gay presses, I actually got a good reading from an editor at Lethe Press, which is one of our great sort of small gay presses, and he said the book wasn't right for him, but he put me in touch with Jerry Wheeler, who ended up being my editor on this project, who got me hooked up with Wild City Press, which is a relatively young gay press, about 2 years in, and I just, you know, guys there, Ethan Day, Jeff Knight, I just really want to thank them for their dedication to gay fiction.
Right.
It's really what they're doing. And, you know, once upon a time, we would have decried this as, oh, the ghetto of gay fiction. Can't we be published along with everybody else? But I'm thrilled to be published by a press that is dedicated to gay fiction. I still think that's an important need, and it doesn't feel marginalized to me or anything less than a so-called mainstream house. And so, you know, I had a lot of rejection, and I then got lucky to find the one or two people who really liked the book, and that's what it takes. And so to your questioner, I just think it's about persistence and letting yourself try some more creative approaches to presses that you might not think of on first glance.
Good. Thank you. Well, that is true. It's just keep at it. And yes, you know, I've watched, you know, everything just kind of go boom, boom, boom. And you know, we had I think is NIAID still in business, the lesbian press?
I believe NIAID might still be in business. And I believe they do primarily lesbian work, but they've done a lot of great work in the past.
Right. I think NIAID's the only one of the old, you know, the old staunch, you know, gay presses that's still putting out fiction. Everyone else is all brand new, which is good. I mean, I agree with you. I think that I don't feel marginalized that publishers are gay publishers because I think you have more freedom. I don't think they're going to edit you talking about piss or BDSM or something that might be have an ick factor for a very liberal, open-minded publisher who just doesn't understand that for a gay man reading about piss, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I don't like it, but, you know, it just goes right by me. You know what I mean? Go ahead.
Right. What's interesting, though, is that I do consider my novel a gay novel. It makes sense to me that it's a gay press, but a lot of my straight friends and readers tell me, this isn't a gay novel. I'm a straight person, and it spoke to me. I learned things.
Right.
So that's the frustrating thing, that we know that these novels actually have potential to reach larger audiences, but people running the numbers often don't believe that.
That's correct. They don't. Well, it's a rough – publishing's rough not just for the gay press. It's for everybody right now. We're in a minefield right now. We're at about the 1 minute mark of this fastest 30 minutes of your life. Did you see this? okay, so I'm a young 21-year-old – pimply faced young guy walks up to you at a bookstore at a book and asks you, I want to be just like you, Mr. Stokes. How do I do that?
First of all, no one has ever said that to me, nor will they ever say that to me, but it's a fun little fantasy. So let's play it out.
Okay.
I'm going to go back to an earlier answer. I think my world got bigger than it was because I started reading. And that led to everything that followed. I mean, I grew up as a gay kid in South Carolina in the 70s and 80s. I didn't have the role models that are perhaps available now, but I first discovered a way into a bigger world, a bigger sense of myself through gay fiction. And so, you know, we think that reading is entertainment. It's passing the time. I actually think it has the potential to change your life, to make your life a bigger place, to make possibility more possible. And I think that does a lot of work. Just be a reader. And
okay,
wherever
good.
That leads you, I think something interesting is going to happen.
Thank you so much. This has been a great time. Good night.
Nate, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Good night, all. Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, good night. Bye-bye.